Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by Mlondi Mluli. Mlondi, how are you doing, man?
Good evening, Nick, and thank you very much for having me back in the show, man. It's been a while. Thanks. It's nice to be back in your show.
And very good to have you back. And Mlondi has accomplished something great recently, which is that he's just gotten his master's in economics. So well done to you, sir. This is... this is no small feat. So well done, and thanks for coming back on the show. We are also joined today with the wise and venerable Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you doing, sir?
I'm okay, but I must point out I am not as well educated as Mlondi.
Well, neither am I. I mean, we're all you are the first amongst equals here, Mlondi, today. So thank you very much for gracing us. All right, first story. And I must say the first two stories, and you'll see what I'm getting at when we get to the second one, it kind of seems like we're back in 2014. But Jacob Zuma has announced to the world, to the public, to South Africans at large, that he is willing to make himself available for ANC chairperson. He's also endorsed his ex-wife, Nkosi Sikelel Dlamini Zuma, for president. Despite the fact that, as we talked about yesterday, Zweli Mkhize seems to have tied up all of the nominations, or at least the majority of nominations from KZN, for their backing for leadership of the ANC. So in a statement released shortly before midnight on Monday, which is a bit weird. I mean, I don't know why you put out a media statement 5 minutes to 12, but whatever. Zuma endorsed Nkosi Sikelel Dlamini Zuma, and said that he remains the most capable to lead the ANC, that she remains the most capable to lead the ANC, and that her leadership capabilities and understanding of the ANC, among others, is unrivaled. He also said that the other candidates for ANC president have dismally failed, and that the only people supporting them are those who have a lot of money. He also has said that if the branches wish it, he shall stand as chairperson of the ANC. This is a very annoying trait in the ANC where no one ever says that they're running of their own desire, but simply because they're called upon by the branches, which is, I think, it reminds me of the Roman Republic, but let's not go down that road. Zuma will be competing against Gwede Mantashe, the ANC Limpopo provincial chairperson, Stan Matabata, as well as the SA Communist Party Deputy General Secretary, David Masondo. Now, because of Zuma's legal troubles and the ANC's so-called step-aside rule, Zuma is not actually eligible to run for ANC chairperson. But, of course, one of the things that's going to be discussed at this conference is whether said step-aside rule should be continued or not. Presumably, that will happen before the election for chairperson takes place. Zuma also said that there's no need for old people to step aside, that the ANC needs a generational mix, and that you shouldn't just give young people a chance because they had messed everything up. He also attacked the ANC in KZN, or at least the former leadership of the ANC in KZN, most importantly, in the former provincial chairperson, Sihle Zikalala, he blames him for diminishing the ANC's electoral results in KZN in the last election. So, Terence, let me start with you. What do you make of this? it seems like Zuma just won't go away. I mean, he's currently fighting, as he has been for a while, multiple court battles. He's an old guy. He's apparently too sick to serve out his sentence of contempt of court in prison. And yet here he is, very willing and able to run for ANC chairperson. What do you make of all this?
Because I suppose it's all a question of priorities, really. Rule of law, party, you know. Unfortunately, within the framework of the ANC's political culture, I think that's probably a very, very easy choice to make. It strikes me, and I think actually Judith February made this point some years ago. One commodity we have none of in South Africa is shame. There is no sense of, you know, actually, I've been a very, very naughty boy, and maybe I should just, you know, retire to my homestead estate, what, you know, whatever the nomenclature is that was paid for by the taxpayer, and, you know, my collection of patrons, and just sort of spin out my old days, keeping myself out of prison. No, you know, not only do I deny it, but I refute it. I stand four square against this. And I think, you know, maybe it's at some level, this is a legitimately held mindset. We are a revolutionary organization engaged in a titanic struggle for the total transformation of the country. We, you know, the idea that I, you know, took a bit here and took a bit there and put this guy in here and that guy in there and the country fell apart, that's not really the issue. You know, that's kind of as good as I can do right now.
Blondie, so looking at some of the other guys running, it's Guedemontashe, Stan Matabata, and David Musondo. Do you think Zuma has a shot at taking over, at becoming ANC chairperson, assuming the step-aside rule is junked? What do you make of that?
To be honest, Nick, I doubt that he does. Zuma, he kind of thinks that he still has power, you know, within the ANC, and surely that isn't the case, because as you'd see, firstly, by this morning's announcements about the KZN PEC that they're going to endorse Zweli Mkhize for leader, or for, you know, or for president of the ANC, and not Nkosazana. So that itself shows that he doesn't have the power that he thinks that he has. And secondly, they also announced that they're going to endorse Stan Matabata, and not him, for chairperson. So that also shows that he doesn't really have the power that he thinks he has. You know, he might have had it before, but now it's gone. The times have changed, and he doesn't enjoy the power that he used to have. So I don't think that he stands a good chance of becoming the, you know, the chairperson, or even getting his preferred a leader. You know.
Yeah, I think I definitely agree with you on that one. You know, the ANC, at least in some cases, still seems that it's important to protect Zuma. But I wonder whether after this electoral conference, they really are going to maybe kind of let him fall by the wayside. You know, who knows if they'll actually let him go to jail. So far, they haven't, despite the fact that he's continuously trying to undermine Ramaphosa. Terrence, what do you make of his prospects? Do you agree with Mlondi and me?
No, I think Mlondi's got it right. I think that this is symbolic rather than actual. I think that there's probably a widespread acceptance in the ANC that Zuma himself, his brand is toxic. It's tarnished, and a lot of people who may have had a great deal of emotional attachment to the ANC, you know, he was in a sense the straw that broke the camel's back, and that sort of chased them away, or at least made opened the Overton window wide enough to question that commitment. Also, by personalizing the pathologies in South Africa around Jacob Zuma, it still leaves a figment of an argument that it's not the ANC that's compromised. It had bad leaders or whatever, but don't worry. And I think, you know, this is why my sense of it at this point is that Ramaphosa's position is relatively safe, because he retains a great deal of personal popularity. Far more than the ANC brand. I personally believe
this is much less than he had previously, right?
Oh, sure, yeah. But you know, it's how many bubbles are on a bar of soap. You know, if you have, you know, half a bar of soap as opposed to no bar of soap, then you're still better off. So yeah, I mean, I think that for their electoral prospects, Ramaphosa is still an asset of sorts. I think if he is to be defenestrated, you would have to have somebody who is relatively untainted, which is very difficult, particularly in that RET faction I see Zweli Mkhize is being punted, and this was a guy who got soiled hands during a period of national collapse. So that's about as bad as, it's not as bad as you get. But once again, no shame.
Yeah, I must say I was rather amused by this whole sort of this kind of criticism in the piece about how Zuma's not making space for the young lions of the ANC to come to the fore and run the party. And you think, who are these people? Who of them has anything? I mean, Zuma at least got elected president and managed to push turnout in some elections higher. So from an ANC perspective, he caused a lot of problems, but he also, at least initially, there was some juice behind him. But who else is going to take over? Who are these young people flooding into the ANC who, from their perspective, even are going to take the party to new heights? I don't know them. Look, I don't see them.
Yeah, go back to the 1990s and into around about 2005, 2006. The ANC, it was really a buyer's market for them. They if you look to make your name in politics, it was probably the ANC Youth League wasn't a bad place to be. You also had various defectors and celebrities and whatever pledging their eternal undying love for the for the ANC, because that was where the action was, and it also had a particular hold on much of the commentariat that while there were political parties, there was the ANC as a kind of natural leader, they embody a kind of people's will or something like that.
And this is exactly why I think the ANC is going to be in trouble going into 2024. It's one of the structural reasons, is because they don't have some bright young spots. Maybe there's some who could emerge still. I mean, any organization that's big enough, there's bound to be some people in there who have some talent or skill or drive or ambition or whatever. But by and large, the whole system just seems rotten and stale. And that is never a good look for a political party, particularly when you're on the ropes, as the ANC seem to be. Okay. Now, we did talk about this a little bit last week, but it's worth perhaps maybe going a little bit more in depth, because we've got more info about it now. And that is that former DA leader, Musime Maani, and current One SA leader. What is this organization called? Anyway, the One SA movement leader. Has decided that he's going to form a political party. We talked about a little bit last week about how he said he had to do this because even though he doesn't like political parties, that the reforms to the Electoral Act had not made it much easier for independents to stand in our system, and therefore he had no choice but to form an electoral political party. He is joining together with the leader of the Ubuntu Integrity Movement, AIM, who I think have a couple of seats around the country, to form this new party. It's going to be called Build One South Africa, or BOSA, I think is the acronym, which is not a terrible acronym, but I'm not sure about the name. Apparently, if you translate it, it can also come out as a Hang, which is a bit awkward. Considering the last party that had that name didn't do so well. Anyway, so Musi, in his announcement, said... it's here where state capture matters. We have men and women who choose to feast while allowing suffering people to die in hospitals, without generators to learn in schools, without books, boards, and latrines. They even arrive at funerals of babies who died in sewage facilities in their fancy SUVs. This demonstrates the forgetfulness of being with fellow South Africans. We have lost our global respect, not only due to how we treat immigrants, but our foreign policy shows a country still stuck in the Soviet Union era. He went on to say that government needs to move towards digitization, that it needs to reform the electoral system, that it needs to free its economy so that people and improve its infrastructure so that people can find jobs and that our factories will work. He said we need to make sure that our formal economy is free, that those who can employ more people, that factories are working 24/7, and we limit easily imported goods that destroy and at times get an unfair advantage on local goods. So some protectionist stuff in there too. Now, we haven't seen the details of kind of what this party's policies are going to be, but I think this is some much more information than we had last week, and some ideas here. It's going to be sort of more free market than the ANC, sort of protectionist, not against immigrants, changing our foreign policy away from the sort of, I guess you could call it the Eastern Bloc, to perhaps towards the Western Bloc or towards something more neutral. And also reforming the electoral system and cracking down on ostentatious displays of wealth, at least in theory. Mlondi, what do you think Musi's prospects of this, or what his party's prospects will be in 2024?
Yeah, thank you, Nick. Well, to be honest, I doubt that Musi will become president, as some might believe, because I've seen on the news, some headlines are saying that could Musi be the next, a president? Well, I doubt. But I think that he could maybe get one or two seats, but I don't really see him becoming the president. And he could maybe just get a few snatch of votes from the social democratic faction of the DA, or maybe those that are social democratics. I mean, social democrats within the DA. So yeah, but I doubt that he'll get that many votes. That'll make him become the president. So yeah.
Yeah, no, he says he's running for president, which is one of the kind of amusing things about this, because it's quite a long shot, I think. And we did talk about that a little bit last time. Terrence, you had some thoughts last week, and you've also just written an article on what the prospects for Musi's party are. So some sensible policy stuff here, some stuff that I don't quite agree with, but at least I can see the argument for it. And of course, Musi, even though I'm not a huge fan of him as a politician, I think that he's extremely charismatic and talented. What do you make of his party's prospects?
Look, I encourage everyone to read my opus in the Daily Friend next week. I'll probably be tinkering with it for the for the coming few days. But look, the broad kernel is the following. I see him tapping into two strains of our political culture. One is the desire for the kind of redemptive messianic figure, and the other one is the party or the political platform outfit, whatever you want to call it. Is often which we try to dodge the word party into the sort of non-political space, we're about the people's interest,
right? It's this talk about moving beyond ideology.
Yeah. We have precedents for this, in various forms. The Federal Alliance under Louis Leite, Hang under Mampele Rampele. We've had a number of parties that have incorporated the word independent in them. We stand outside this pointless ideological fray, and we just focus on the issues and the people. Got to do the hands. And then also there's the idea that we need to invoke civil society, which is it's a big thing in political science. Strong civil society is good for a democracy or whatever. That often seems to be where people who for whatever reason have turned off politics go. They're going to go and work with civil society, do the hands. And I think what you see in Musi's initiative is all of that. I think that there's a couple of hurdles. First of all, if he had done this on departing from the DA, I think there would have been people who would have followed him on that basis. But I think he's lost that market to him and Mashaba.
It looked for a little while like he might even join forces with Action SA. And then Herman seemed to have had a falling out of some kind.
Yeah. The other thing is, what is your offering? Now, with what he said, who can't you run on that platform? And he was speaking to Eusebius McKeyser and saying, it's about values and commitments, not so much about policy, and we want to aggregate independence. But okay, here's the big issue. You find all these community leaders. Now, your farmer from Pofara and your township activist from Davyton or whatever, they both represent their constituencies, they're both on their list. Who's higher up on the list and who's lower down? I mean, this is there's serious political questions here. And, you know, we say, well, you know, we want a health system to work better. Okay, is that NHI? Is that, you know, something else? We want an entrepreneurial education for our kids. Great. Kids in schools have to take a subject called economic and management sciences, which is supposed to encourage that. What are we going to be doing differently? Should we be doing this? Or shouldn't we encourage a more solidaristic and socialist idea about, you know, Ubuntu and whatever? I mean, Ubuntu is his thing. Exactly what is that? Another point that Eusebius made. Yes, Moonchild Eusebius, that one. It was an interesting discussion. I'll listen to wherever I can get my information, and you know sometimes that's Eusebius. Now he said, okay, well you know non-racism could mean color blindness, or as Eusebius would say, anti-racism, which I don't think is the same thing, but I think the point is valid. You know, are we being non-racialist by color coding everything and saying, well you know we need to split things up into proportions, or by saying we shouldn't look at it at all? You know, those are issues that have been live in South Africa since, you know, well, as long as I can remember. I even think those values are likely to be contested. Man, you know, let me channel my inner Jordan Peterson. Man, this is difficult stuff.
Yeah, what is that John Maynard Keynes quote about how someone who's any politician who says he's above ideology is usually the slave of some defunct economist. And I think this is always a problem. You know, there's this great political desire. You know, ideology, it sounds dirty. It comes this connotation of being restrictive and closed-minded and just, you know, not very thoughtful. And yet, when you don't have some sort of ideological or pole from which to guide yourself, you often find yourself walking into very strange, twisted knots that don't make a lot of sense, and you can lose your way very quickly. But anyway,
if I could just make a comment on that. About 15 years ago, there was an article in the journal Foreign Affairs about Latin America's two lefts. They said they were the essentially non-ideological populist Peronist types. You know, we just don't like elites, and they were the Marxists. And so now actually, you look at the ones that managed to make the transition into some sort of sense. It was actually the more hardline ideological people, because they were actually used to thinking through issues, and they could see, well, you know, nationalizing everything didn't work. So that's the evidence. This is what we used to believe. But when everything was just about, you know, like we'll get the people into the streets, you know, you couldn't do that, and you ended up with Chavez and Morales and whatever. Interesting point, I think.
Yeah, no, definitely something to keep in mind. All right. Lastly, let's just talk about some of the latest drama with Eskom. So News24 is reporting today that Pravin Gordhan is looking to replace or at least significantly change the board of Eskom. So up till now, the board of Eskom has been very supportive of André de Ruyter, the CEO of Eskom. However, it has a lot of vacancies after a large number of them resigned in 2018 and have not been replaced. So there's some confusion as to what exactly Gordhan is going to do. Is he just going to fill the empty spaces? Is he going to throw everyone out and put in a new board? News24 also reports that the government cabinet thinks that André de Ruyter should be fired, or at least pushed aside, that there's a lot of opposition to him right now. And so we face the prospect, and this has been, I think, looming over for a while, of yet another CEO for Eskom if André de Ruyter is chucked out. So we don't know whether it's going to happen, but let's at least consider the possibility. And all the while this politicking is going on, there's been some really good reporting, actually, from the mainstream about the costs of load shedding on ordinary people. So, and also once again from News24, there was a piece about a small business owner in Johannesburg who runs a printing business. He shares his space with a salon, and he is really struggling. When he was interviewed, he was sitting on a couch looking very upset. And he said to the journalist, "I'm just useless." And he pointed at the empty chairs that are normally filled with customers in the salon next door. He went on to say, "These are situations daily since the start of load shedding." I spend all my time giving refunds to customers right now. I can't cope with this anymore. I still have to pay rent. I still have to buy food for myself. And my business is struggling. So, you know, as annoying as it is for every South African to go through load shedding in some ways, for small business owners and particularly those who can't afford generators and such, it really is ruining their lives in a lot of ways. So the faster we fix this crisis, the better. Mlondi, what's your view on Cabinet's hard stance on Derrida? You had some thoughts on Eskom and that.
Yeah, well, Nick, to be honest, Eskom is a dead organization, and I don't see why government is so keen on trying to make it work. They just don't give up, don't they? You know, so I think that the answer
they're using SAA as the model, right? I mean, SAA is still a zombie organization that continues to shamble forward, even though it's
exactly and exactly. So the answer is a privatization, and I don't get why government is so adamant on trying to get Eskom to work, because you know it's taking billions of rands. You know that could be better spent elsewhere, and we just don't need Eskom. Or what's needed is IPPs, and yeah. So yeah, that's my point on it.
So and even as the crisis has mounted, governments very grudgingly moved towards some of these IPP things. For example, I think they have signed a contract with some IPPs now to get offshore wind generation, but it's still relatively small amounts. Terence, what do you make of this story? Do you think Derrida is going to be chopped, or do you think he will hang on?
You know, I think that, yeah, you can chop the head off, but I think these problems are now systemic. The capacity of the organization was run down. It wasn't expanded when it needed to be in the 1990s. So you're dealing with a whole lot of legacy issues. The other thing is, you know, which of the thousand eagerly awaiting CEOs actually wants that job? There was a little piece when Derrida was appointed, and there was criticism that they came up with a white male, and I think it was a cabinet source or you know, someone involved in the appointment leaked that they had actually tried to find a black candidate and no one was interested. They just said no. In fact, I think the Black Business Council said something about other CEOs were the abattoirs of black executives. I would take out the whole race thing. I don't think it's a particularly attractive job. So yeah, you know, if you want to get rid of him, by all means, do so. I don't think it really changed the dynamic much. Interestingly, News24 also ran a piece today that they had approached Gord Gordhan and said, to what extent is cadre deployment a factor in all this? Why haven't these positions been filled? And apparently, sort of a reluctance to respond. One wonders whether, you know, there's certain cadres for whom these seats are earmarked. I think that probably features within official thinking as much as does the lack of power. Who benefits from the goodies?
No, exactly. All right, so with that gloomy piece of news out of the way, let us focus on something a little bit more whimsical. And this is a scandal rocking the world of chess right now. So the world's top chess player, Magnus Carlsen, has accused a teenage prodigy who he recently played a match against of cheating. This prodigy, they were playing a match, and Carlsen didn't want to continue with it because of the cheating. The specific allegation was that Carlsen's opponent was using anal beads as a method by which to transmit secret signals to himself from an accomplice, that the accomplice would buzz said beads every time to give him advice on what move to make next. And said accomplice would presumably be using some sort of computer program to map out what the best moves would be. His opponent, of course, denied this, and I believe even threatened to strip naked to prove that, in fact, he was not cheating. Terence, your thoughts?
this is either something out of an X-Files alien abduction movie or a parody done by Hustler Video. I cannot describe it to anything else. You know, maybe you know, the Queen's Gambit has something coming to a store near you. Yes, you guys all know what that store is. What is simply blown away. Apparently, you can cheat at chess, although I've never been able to sort of master chess. I've never been a good chess player. But it just seems that, you know, if you're going to like come up with a 50 like top ways to cheat, sticking a butt plug in and getting electric shocks, I mean, surely, to use that South African phrase, surely there's like some other way you could do it. Really?
Monty, do you have anything to add?
No.
Anyway, so with that, I think we have a run out of time for today. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we will see you tomorrow on the Daily Print Show. Cheers, everyone.